And now, from the Green 960 studios in San Francisco, this is an organic conversation with Helga Hellberg.
And welcome to this week's edition of An Organic Conversation, a show about food, relationships, and life itself. I'm your host, Helga Hellberg. I hope you had a great week. Thank you for all your comments that we received. Mike from Santa Monica, California says, I love your show, and you mentioned in a previous show a produce tour through the San Francisco Produce Dock. How can I find more information? Well, we are planning a produce tour here in San Francisco for the end of October, so by next week, I think, we'll be able to announce the date and more information on this gathering, which will be with Mark Mukahi, produce expert, and Al Balak, owner of Good Earth Natural Foods in Fairfax, California, and also a produce whiz. So that will be a lot of fun, guaranteed. Stay tuned, Mike, on that one, and thanks for your comment. Sally from Nevada City says, thank you for your intro about constantly being fed when returning home for a visit of my family. I've always wondered why my mother wouldn't stop feeding me, and now, being a mother myself, it's exactly what I do too. So it must be in my mother DNA. Yes, Sally, it's not your fault. It's what mothers do. It's beautiful. We, on the receiving end, though, just have to learn to accept it better. Thank you, Sally, from Nevada City. If you have a comment or question, please email us at share@anorganicconversation.com. Last weekend, I stopped at a tiny, nondescript lemonade stand in my hometown. The owner of the stand was a six-year-old girl named Lucy. 50 cents a glass, she said, or two for a dollar, and then you get a third one as a gift. I was confused and said, so then it's three for a dollar, right? But she insisted and said, slightly annoyed with me as if I had made fun of her or not getting her point, no, it's two for a dollar, and then you get another one as a gift. I gave in and said, okay, I take two for a dollar. I sipped my lemonade, and it was hands down the best lemonade I've ever had, and Lucy knew it. The amount of freckles she had represented the amount of summer that she had put into her lemonade. It was delicious, rich and ripe Meyer lemons, a tad of cane sugar, and maybe a hint of maple syrup, and lots of love. Pungent, not too sweet, not too sour, just perfect. The lemonade was so good that for a moment I forgot the deal. As I was saying thank you and turning around to walk away, she held up another cup and said with a big smile, Mister, and this one here is for you, from me. I got it. I was reminded of the difference between this world of three for twos and buy one and get one for free, of keeping a deal, and then truly receiving a gift in addition. Lucy was six and already knew the difference. Good for her. You're listening to An Organic Conversation, and we'll be right back after the break. And we're back here to An Organic Conversation. I'm your host, Helga Hellberg. I'm excited about our guest today, a poet, artist, peach and grape farmer, father, and husband, and so much more. But first, as always, here's Dan McGovern with the news.
Good morning. This is Sustainable Food News, your weekly news service on An Organic Conversation, and I'm Dan McGovern. USDA Deputy Secretary Kathleen Merrigan is imagining new growth in local and regional food systems by using underutilized agency funding programs. She imagines a food processor getting a USDA loan to add a second line of equipment and storage facilities to handle certified organic food products to meet local demand. She also imagines an organic cooperative receiving a grant to develop a marketing plan to provide Vermont-grown fruits and vegetables to local schools. Those are just a couple projects that Merrigan laid out in a memo this week, where she identified three underutilized funding programs. One is the Community Facilities Program, which can help nonprofits and cooperatives involved with local foods to obtain equipment or facilities like farmers markets, community kitchens, and food processing centers. Merrigan said there is over $930 million in Recovery Act loan funds and over $31 million in Recovery Act grant funds still available under the Community Facilities Program. Another program is the Business and Industry Guarantee Loan Program, which helps new and existing businesses in rural areas get affordable capital. For instance, using USDA loan money to aggregate local farm products so that the volume is sufficient to serve a large school system, or helping finance a mobile slaughterhouse that supports local free-range poultry growers. There's about $100 million available for farmers, processors, and retailers through that program in fiscal year 2010, thanks to last year's Farm Bill. Priority is given to projects that benefit underserved urban, rural, or tribal communities, which have limited access to affordable, healthy foods, including fruits and vegetables, in grocery stores or farmers markets, as well as a high rate of hunger, food insecurity, or poverty. Finally, the Value-Added Producer Grant Program supports business plan development and working capital expenses. For instance, providing a grant to a Wisconsin farmer to help market pasture-raised lamb to restaurants and stores. The amount available in that grant program will be published in the Federal Register within the next month. 10% of the funds will target beginning farmers and ranchers and socially disadvantaged farmers and ranchers. North America's largest producer of organic jams and spreads, Crofters Food Limited, was recognized Friday by the Canadian government as an innovation leader for its approach to organic food production. Located in Parry Sound, Ontario, Crofters has been producing organic jams, preserves, and spreads since 1989. Crofters operates processing and laboratory equipment that few manufacturing companies in North America are using. The jams, rather than being boiled in open kettles, are processed in specialized vacuum evaporation equipment where the boiling point is lower, preserving the nutritional value and color of the fruit. Under its rigorous quality management protocol, the company performs gas chromatographic testing for herbicides and pesticides, as well as testing to ensure the presence of antioxidants. Supermarket chain Publix this week rolled out a new shelf tag program to distinguish organic and natural food products rather than having to look at the details of the product label itself. The chain operates over 1,000 stores in Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, Alabama, and Tennessee. For organic products, shelf tags designate them made with at least 95% organic ingredients, as well as products made with 70 to 94% organic ingredients. The shelf tag for natural products tells shoppers the item is minimally processed, contains no artificial colors, flavors, preservatives, or sweeteners, or that the item is produced in a way that minimizes any negative impact on the environment, according to the company. This is Sustainable Food News, your weekly news service on an organic conversation. I'm Dan McGovern.
And thank you, Dan, for this weekly service. Wonderful. Let's talk about the shelf tags for a second. So organic has three categories to begin with, right? 100% organic, which means every ingredient has to be organic. Then if it just says organic, it means 95 has to be organic. And less than 95 is made with organic ingredients. Those are all captured by this new shelf identification system?
They lump together the 100% and the 95% and more. And like you said, below 95%, of course, there's the threshold there. So there's those three shelf tags. But what's interesting is that the natural shelf tag says that it minimizes any negative impact on the environment, which I thought was an interesting piece in there about natural, but not organic, because you can have pesticides in some of the natural products.
So what does organic say?
It doesn't have that designation on the shelf tag.
Okay. We'll look further into that for sure. And what market is that at?
That's at Publix supermarkets in the Southeast.
They have quite a few hundred, right?
Over 1,000 stores, yeah.
Great. And then Kathleen Merrigan, I was just talking with our guest today before the show started on mobile slaughter units and community food kitchens. There's clearly a new wind blowing out of the USDA office, which is wonderful. That's a pretty big commitment. Is that money that Kathleen Merrigan is dedicating or announcing part of the farm bill, or is that an extra pot?
Some of it's part of the farm bill. For instance, the business guarantee loan program is part of the farm bill. That there's also money that's in the community's facilities program, which is close to $1 billion. But that's part of the Recovery Act. So those are part of the recovery funds that are made available. And what she's doing is she's highlighting that this money is available. These things can happen. And when I was saying, imagine this memo that she put out was almost poetic in how she
a vision.
Yeah. How she described this can really happen. We can make these things a reality.
Beautiful. Thank you. Thanks, Dan McGovern, Sustainable Food News. Mas Masumoto, welcome to an organic conversation.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure. And it's a pleasure hearing Dan's news. It reminded me of growing up and hearing the farm report on the AM radio. And usually they had a goofy song that went with it, somebody whistling like out of Andy Griffith Show or something. But that was a pleasure to hear.
We have pretty goofy songs here, too. They're coming later. Do you feel that new policy change from USDA on a farm level?
Absolutely. The stories that you're, the word that you're hearing out, I think there's a kind of honesty that's coming out, which is very refreshing. And that honesty reflects in looking towards the future. So you talked about the vision, the imagining process of something. That's something we haven't heard, because for the last certainly 8 years, if not longer, we were always looking backwards.
What worked or what didn't work.
And wanting to return really to a time when rural America had more population, food systems were in a very different way, and it was as if we wanted to return to that. And I see now, finally, we're looking forward, and I find that so refreshing.
How does that affect directly your farm? Have you benefited from it in any way already, other than being more hopeful and...
I think one way I've benefited is there's this new line of communication open. Uh-huh. The old school was always, no, things like the farm bill, that's just for farmers to worry about. The public shouldn't even be involved in the debate. Clearly, with the last farm bill, it was the stirring of the pot. Things were starting to change. Yeah. And now the communication is open so that people are not only wanting to know who grows their food and how it's grown, but they want to know more of the story behind it. Ergo, some of the battles over labeling, which is really a battle over what story is being told and what can the public see is authentic in those stories, and ultimately, what can they trust? That's where I think the government does have a role, that it can be that voice of trust, which is rare, because most people say you can't trust the government and things of that sort. But then the other hand, are you going to trust the marketers? Are you going to trust the corporations? And the farmer's voice, because there's not many of us, always got lost. And even more so, the organic farmer, the sustainable farmer, the local farmer, our voices were like a whisper, because there just wasn't much of us.
Yeah.
But now I see that new communication opening up.
And for me, it's like, can we trust the government? Yes, that's an important question. But it's almost, can we trust the dialogue, right?
Yeah.
Because it's all of a sudden the public, or agriculture is a public health conversation.
Yeah,
and a community health conversation.
And so long as issues like food safety or something was relegated to regulators, the public got left out of that. That's changing now. It's massively changing with not only the stories that are out, but the way stories are getting out.
That's right.
It's not the traditional gatekeepers of information and news controlling what gets. It's just flooding out there. And it's almost as if there's a democratization of our food. And I love that
democracy
idea.
Democracy now.
Yes, absolutely.
Finally. How's your farm looking? You're planting. Tell us about it. You have 80 acres.
80 acres, and we just about
peaches.
two weeks ago we finished our peaches and nectarines.
Was it a good year?
It was a good year. Prices were a little lower. And I was worried they'd be a lot lower. So I'm very happy with what happened. It's a classic case, too. My last variety of nectarine, of my organic nectarines, I stumbled a little. I made some mistakes. The weather caused a few things. It was probably because it was the last variety. I didn't pay quite as much attention to
like
it.
Like what? What mistakes?
Mainly, I let it get a little... It ripened from the inside out, so it was... So when I picked it, I really should have picked it 2 days earlier. So it started to bruise.
2 days
and
earlier.
I had arrival problems on the other end.
Why would you pick it 2 days late, Moss? Come on.
Because like everything I do, I want to reach that perfect point of maturity that I seek perfection. And I thought I got it, but I was really 2 days beyond perfection. And I didn't know it till after we picked. And then we started having some problems. And of course, because it was the last variety, I'm going to live with this throughout the whole winter. Trying to
for
think
the rest
about.
Of your life. I mean, this show will be on iTunes in a couple hours.
Oh no, I've confessed.
This is history now.
I've confessed now. But now we start our grapes, and all of our grapes we make into organic raisins. And grapes are dried into raisins in two very distinct ways. The traditional way was that around this time of the year, end of August, early September, farmers would get paper trays that are about 2 feet by 3 feet in size, pick the green grapes, lay them on the tray in the sun, and wonderfully using the power of solar energy, in about 3 weeks, they dry into raisins.
That's starting to... The word is pucker, right?
Yeah, they start to pucker. They start to shrivel.
Not quite as nice.
And the danger is, of course, about every 10 years, you get a freak rainstorm that goes through. And when it rains on these grapes turning into, they start to rot and mold. The other way some of us are starting to do in the industry is drying them on the vine, where we'll cut the canes or the branches about mid-August, and then the grapes naturally dry on the vine. The process takes much longer.
Outside or indoors?
No, still on the vine itself. They're all on the vine.
But where do you store them during that time? Still outside?
You watch them shrivel from green grapes into tan grapes into really, actually, it turned like a purple color. Uh-huh. And then they start getting the wrinkles. And then after the wrinkles, they get fine wrinkles. And then by the end of October, they're finally dried in the raisins, which meant you have exposure to rain about 2 to 3 times longer. I like this method of drying them on the vine mainly because it changes our labor relationship.
So again, you cut the branch and you lay the branch next to the vine on the ground?
No, the branch stays on the trellis wire.
I should have explained
that all of our Thompson seedless, which most raisins are made from, are all trellised with wires.
Yes,
and we wrap the branch around the wire.
Yes, cut them and they just keep hanging there.
Exactly, and then when we cut them, and they naturally dry. It's a wonderful process, and for about 2 months, you get this wonderful aroma when you walk through the vineyards, because you could smell the grapes drying, the caramelization process. There is still a danger of rain. But the biggest advantage for me is when you're cutting them to dry them on the ground, you need a large labor pool in a very short amount of time. And to me, I wanted to keep a smaller labor force, and really it's just one family that works for me, and they could do 80 to 90% of this work.
Labor force, we're talking your wife and your daughter and your son,
wife,
right?
Daughter, and then I hire two people too. Okay. And instead of having just, you know, a two-week period where I need 40 workers, it's these two other people plus us stretched out over 2 or 3 months. Of course, the kids say, oh, this is just a way of cheap
labor.
Of stretching the work out over more amount of time. But I really like that idea because it's changing the human capital that we have on the farm, in that we're using my workers in a longer period of time. They like it because they have steadier work, and it eases, right? So when we finish the raisins, it's about time we could turn around and start pruning the trees. So it creates that stability.
What does it do to the product? Does a raisin shriveled or dried, or a grape dried into a raisin on the vine, just cut from the vine but still on it, churn out a different product? What's the?
It's slightly different. The flavor is slightly different. I like to think of it, if you dry them in the sun, they get more of a caramelized flavor. If you dry them on the vine, you get a caramelized flavor mixed with a little fruitiness. It just has to do with the way and the process of it. And I like making those distinctions. Of course, probably, you know, 90% of the public aren't necessarily raisin connoisseurs. But I've been working with a few restaurants who do notice the difference in flavor and are playing with that flavor a little. And I love that. It's
Knowing that you missed your 48-hour window to create the perfect nectarine, I'm sure you put as much effort into your raisins. I'm talking with Mas Masumoto today. Poet, artist, activist, father, husband, and peach, nectarine, and grape farmer in Fresno on the Masumoto family farm. This is an organic conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg. We'll be right back after the break.
An Organic Conversation is brought to you by Svatica Skincare. Founded by Janet Lee Katzen, Svatica is a holistic approach to skincare that is 100% pure and natural, free of synthetic chemicals, and includes organic and wild-crafted ingredients. For more information about Svatica Skincare products and the Svatica Spa, visit svatica.com. That's Svatika.com.
Hi, I'm Peter Walsh. My wife and I founded Manika Jewelry with the intention to offer a different kind of jewelry. Beautiful, made by local Bay Area artists, and without a social or environmental compromise. Our featured designers use reclaimed precious metals and Kimberly certified gemstones. It's jewelry made with heart and soul. Come visit our store just off Union Square at 11 Maiden Lane in San Francisco, or visit our website at manikajewelry.com.
For the ultimate West Marin experience, visit Toby's Feed Barn in Point Reyes Station, home of the Point Reyes Farmers Market every Saturday. Toby's Feed Barn features organic produce, native plants, gifts, books, an organic coffee bar, an art gallery, concerts, even daily yoga classes. Toby's Feed Barn in downtown Point Reyes Station, open 7 days a week, family-owned and operated since 1942, a West Marin original. For more information, visit tobysfeedbarn.com.
Fry Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family-owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Fry never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Fry organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Fry Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines, without added sulfites. Available at grocery stores and online at frywine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
Marin Organic is an association of organic producers in Marin County, California, which has become one of the most progressive voices in the sustainable food movement in the United States. Through its many innovative initiatives, such as a school lunch and gleaning program, Marin Organic is creating a healthy, sustainable, and safe environment for all beings, today and for generations to come. Please become a partner in our work by visiting marinorganic.org and by pledging your support now. Thank you.
And we are back here to an organic conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg. And my guest today is Mas Masumoto, poet, artist, peach, nectarine, and grape farmer near Fresno, south of Fresno, California. Mas, how did you end up in Fresno? What's the story of your land?
It's really the story of our family that goes back three generations. My grandparents immigrated from Japan. They were raised on farms in Japan. My grandfathers were second sons, meaning that they weren't going to inherit the land in Japan. So they developed this pioneer spirit. They immigrated at the beginning of the last century, ended up coming to Fresno area because they were large populations of immigrants from two areas or two states in Japan, Hiroshima and Kumamoto. Just like immigrant patterns, people tended to go where their own people were. And that's how they were farm workers when they arrived in America because of alien land laws. They were not able to purchase land. And it was only the second generation, the Nisei generation, that my parents were they able to buy land. And we bought our farm right after relocation of World War II when my dad and mom came back.
And you told me a story about your parents having to leave the coastal areas to be shipped to Arizona.
And during World War II, right after the bombing of Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, there was a mass hysteria that swept the country. And the political powers that be were looking for an enemy. Uh-huh. And they found the enemy, so-called enemy, in Japanese Americans because my family looked like Japanese from Japan. So they naturally assumed somehow that we were related to the bombing of Pearl Harbor.
Were they U.S. citizens?
Yes. I mean, all the children. My parents were born in the United States. They were U.S. citizens. And my grandparents were legal immigrants. They had documents and everything. But what happened was there was this mass hysteria that insisted all Japanese Americans, and it was about 120,000 that were along the West Coast from Oregon down to California, be interned and evacuated. They were forced to leave their homes, given a week or two to sell all their possessions from a farm to all their farm equipment. People in the cities had to sell what they had, boarded trains to different...
Or you couldn't even keep your house. You had to sell.
Oh, no. Well, some managed if they found someone who took care of it.
Oh, sure.
But again, there was so much hysteria. No one wanted to help these Japs, as they called them. So all 120,000 Americans of Japanese descent had to be relocated into about 10 different relocation centers scattered across the United States because, again, they didn't want to put everyone in one site because they thought it might be dangerous. So they went to such remote places as Heart Mountain, Wyoming, Jerome, Arkansas, and my parents were in Gila River, Arizona, which is about 20 miles south of Phoenix in the middle of the desert. And this was their home for 4 years.
What was the fear that there would be acts of sabotage
exactly.
of the coast?
Exactly, that there would be, they called
invasion.
A kind of a fifth column. In other words, that the Japanese would be launching their assault on the American homeland, I mean America, by using spies that my parents, and my mom was 13 at the time, and she would, as if she would be a spy and help defeat the United States. It was an insane, it was racist, it was a terrible, brutal act that occurred, and it changed Japanese American community forever, especially in the rural areas, because suddenly everyone lost their land. And also the natural progression of immigrant populations in rural areas was that they established, the first generation tries to get a foothold.
Sure.
The second generation is maybe able to purchase land and start businesses. And then the third generation could then benefit from all that. That stopped in 1942.
How long did that go on? Were you able to return?
They returned in around 1946. A lot of them returned because they had no other place to go. Others didn't. I had aunts and uncles that left and went to L.A. and lived in different areas. Some lived in Chicago. One uncle lived in Detroit because why would they come back to Fresno? There was nothing left for them. So it changed family dynamics in that sense, too.
And we were talking about the irony of being incarcerated and then actually a year later or during the same war asked to join the U.S. Army to fight against...
There were so many tragic ironies. My uncle, the oldest brother in my dad's family, had been drafted right before the war. So he was actually in the army when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor and U.S. declared war, and they didn't know what to do with him because he looked like the enemy. And yet he had been drafted and was trained.
And he was a
US
citizen.
So they started trying to train them without guns in the service because they were afraid that they would somehow turn the guns on other U.S. forces. During the relocation period around 1945, no one knew exactly what was going to happen with the war. So they needed more able-bodied men. So they drafted many of the Nisei, and my dad was drafted out of this relocation camp where they had barbed wire around them. The irony was just tragic
yeah.
that happened. But he went ahead and served. At that time, there
Has he ever shared with you how, like, for him, you're being imprisoned and then being asked to fight for the country that just imprisoned you? It seems impossible.
That generation tended to be fairly quiet and reserved, partly cultural, but I think partly because of the deep wound that occurred. Growing up, my parents rarely talked about this. It was a secret, almost as if they were ashamed of it. And of course, it wasn't a personal shame. It was a public shame, which created a different dimension. Yeah. And so my dad served, came out of the army. And then the question was, where does the family go? And that's why we ended up back in Fresno, because it was the only, quote, home that they knew. And he came back and he started he was a farm worker again after serving and undergoing all of that.
And then he purchased those 80 acres right away, or how did the family farm, the Masumoto family farm, get established?
My dad believed in the American system, where he thought
Still,
that the way to, despite
after being treated.
despite all that, he thought the way to become American was to own land and own property. So he took a huge risk, bought 40 acres, he jokingly called it 40 acres of rocks, because we didn't have money. He bought the cheapest land, which was also the worst land.
Which had the most marginal soil.
Marginal land. It was full of hardpan rock, is what is the rock of the Central Valley. And it's a curse to farmers, because you can't farm on it. So he spent the first...
Why? Because it kills your equipment when you... And
the hardpan usually floats around. It's in these large slabs, and it's sitting around 2 to 3 feet below the topsoil, and it's hiding. So that you would plant a vine or a tree, and the first year or two it may grow okay, but then the
roots
can expand,
it, right.
Water starts sitting on top of this rock, you get root rot,
yeah.
All kinds of issues. It's a treacherous, insidious rock. So my dad spent about 2 to 3 years trying to clear half the farm. Half the farm was okay, the other half was full of this rock. He spent 2 or 3 years clearing rock by rock, clearing this field so we could now have luscious grapes and
meaning
and
digging out the rocks, trying
digging,
to find
he used dynamite. There was this movie Jean de Fluette that I remember seeing about this farmer who wants the farm and he needs to build a well, so he uses dynamite and he ends up killing himself. My dad didn't kill himself, fortunately, but that he used dynamite to clear the land of these rocks, because it was the only way to break these large slabs into smaller ones that you then could load onto a wagon or
move
a truck
away.
And
yeah.
Move away. And that was part of the legacy. And part of that's what I try to capture in Wisdom of the Last Farmer, how farming involves that sense of history, literally understanding this field that now grows luscious grapes only occurred because of the hard physical work of my dad. His legacy is in that field. That's where his story lies. And that's what I tried to capture in Wisdom of the Last Farmer.
I'm talking with Mas Masumoto, poet, farmer, activist, artist, out of South Fresno from the Masumoto family farm. You're listening to An Organic Conversation. Where do you come in? When did you decide that you would take over, run the family farm?
I was born after the war, of course, and grew up on this farm as a typical farm kid. And as a typical farm kid, I couldn't wait to get away from the farm. So I told my dad I would never farm. And ironically,
were you wrong.
Well, the irony was my grandfathers were second sons. That's why they ended up farming. My dad was a second son, and he ended up coming back to having to take care of the farm. And I'm a second son, so I left the farm thinking I was never groomed to train to take over the farm. Left, ran away for college. At a certain point, realized I belonged on the land. I just belonged working with the earth. So then I came back to the farm about in the mid-70s and started taking over. And one of the
and your brother didn't want to.
The bittersweet irony was, like many family farms, we had some horrendous years, and there were some really difficult years in the mid-60s when my brother was just ready to go to college. And my parents, I remember the meeting that they had with him, in a way told him not to come back to the farm because it was going to be too much work. There's a better life for him. So in this really a bittersweet way, he was told not to come home. and at the same time given the opportunity to move forward. So he wasn't going to take over the farm. I have an older sister who wasn't going to be involved, so I was maybe...
So they're doing something else now?
My brother is an electrical engineer, very brilliant, and my sister was a nurse and went in a very different direction. So it was sort of up to me. So when I did come back to the farm, my dad was both happy and very skeptical, because remember, I told him I'd never come back at the same time. And one of the things I started doing was I thought, you know, I'm going to try to farm differently. And for a number of reasons, both economic, but a lot had to do with the environmental issues, the justice issues, I started farming organically. And that was the big contribution, you could say, I made to the farm.
And kind of beautiful. I mean, bittersweet, yes, but out of that, out of those years of hard times and poor harvests, your legacy was born, right? You were, because of that, enabled to come back to the farm and take over.
And of course, it's almost as if it was a story, a novel unfolding. Of course, in the beginning, you don't know it's going to end that way. So you're not, you know, you're going through.
I noticed. Why is that? Yeah, if we only knew.
I think it's part of that wonderful naivete that you have when you follow your passion, that you're not sure what's going to happen. And because of that, you're not going into a profession with an end in sight. You're going in because you have
it.
Passion. And with that passion, you just forge through. And if things are fortunate and you make a few good decisions, some accidental along the way, hopefully you survive after a couple decades.
So when did you get bitten by the farming bug? When did you find your passion? Knowing, was it just the love to the land that you knew has had so much family tradition that to continue that, or were you really a farmer? Were you really, why peaches? Why, you know,
it was,
are you coming from the fruit side or more an honoring of the land?
It was all of them blended together. Both that combination of that sense of history that I talked about, that sense of memory. That's part of it. And also there is this passion of loving to work outside with your hands in the dirt and enjoying the precarious nature of weather. I love the fact that weather is non-linear. Too much of the world believes life could be structured, and nature has a wonderful way, especially the weather, of saying, nope, that's not how it works. I like that idea. And it's part of maybe the artist part of me. And at the same time, part of what happened with myself was when I came back to the farm, I started getting a sense of the richness of story around me. And at that time, I started thinking maybe I should write a little. And that's partly when my birth of writing occurred. And it was simultaneously, and there wasn't one moment where I discovered it all. It was all blended together, very much how farming is integrated with many facets of one's life.
And we'll talk about that right after the break. I'm talking to Maz Masumoto, farmer, activist, poet out of Fresno, California. This is an Organic Conversation, and we'll be right back after the break.
Scott tissue that I wish you saw. Sock after Mr. Know It All. I'll close your eyes and I'll kiss you, cause with the birds I'll share. With the birds I'll share this.
An Organic Conversation is brought to you by Svatica Skincare. Founded by Janet Lee Katzen, Svatica is a holistic approach to skincare that is 100% pure and natural, free of synthetic chemicals, and includes organic and wild-crafted ingredients. For more information about Svatica Skincare products and the Svatica Spa, visit svatica.com. That's SPHATIKA.com.
Marin Organic is an association of organic producers in Marin County, California, which has become one of the most progressive voices in the sustainable food movement in the United States. Through its many innovative initiatives, such as a school lunch and gleaning program, Marin Organic is creating a healthy, sustainable, and safe environment for all beings, today and for generations to come. Please become a partner in our work by visiting marinorganic.org and by pledging your support now. Thank you.
Fry Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family-owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Fry never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Fry organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Fry Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines without added sulfites. Available at grocery stores and online at frywine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
Are you looking for a romantic and unusual location in the Bay Area for your wedding or upcoming anniversary? Toby's Feed Barn offers the perfect venue for your celebration. A rustic barn in the heart of beautiful West Marin, with local organic caterers ready to delight your guests amid bales of hay. Toby's Feed Barn in downtown Point Reyes Station. Open 7 days a week. Family owned and operated since 1942. A West Marin original. For more information, visit tobysfeedbarn.com.
Sustainable Food News is the premier source of daily news and market information for the organic, sustainable, and natural food industries. Headline after headline, Sustainable Food News reports on a profound shift in food buying habits as more and more people begin to understand the impact of their purchases on the environment and communities around the world. Join Dan McGovern, publisher of Sustainable Food News, every Saturday morning on An Organic Conversation. For more information, visit www.sustainablefoodnews.com.
And we are back here to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg, and my guest today is Mas Masumoto, nectarine and peach farmer, poet and artist, and also author of his new book, Wisdom of the Last Farmer. Mas, before the break, you were talking about the history of the soil, literally, and how it affects your work now. Why did you pick the crops you are now growing? Because the soil was best for it, or what's your personal relationship to
it? It was a combination of different things. One, that climate in Fresno. Peaches and nectarines love hot weather and dry weather. They originated from the highlands of China. So in a way, you know, the heat of Fresno mimics that. And I think the fruit loved that weather, and they liked the sandy loam soils we're in, especially the varieties that we're growing. And the grapes in that area, we always made them into raisins, because that's the spot in the nation where you'll get this 90-100 degree heat to dry them into raisins.
Lots of sugar.
Sugar, and you avoid these fall rains. Because if you go maybe 50 miles north, you're going to get a northerly storm. If you go too far south, you get sometimes monsoonal weather that come up from a hurricane off of Baja or something like that. Fresno, I'm sure they found this by trial and error after they got rained on up in Sacramento and rained on down south or something, that, you know,
Fresno,
we'll go
was
to
left.
Fresno and everything. And the other reason why we did grow that was my dad was part, you know, believed in that old simple system of farmers of wanting to diversify their crop. So we had stone fruit, the peaches, plums. We actually grew some plums at one time, and nectarines, because they were a different crop. They were a fresh crop that was harvested from May until August. Raisins were a later summer crop in August and September, and a very different marketing program, very different pricing program. So the premise is, if the market and you screwed up with the peaches, the grapes would get you through, or vice versa.
Right, you would always survive on one. You said during the break that you didn't understand plums, so you dropped them. What's your relationship to your peaches? How do you interact with them? Like, understanding a plum is a very beautiful way of putting it.
I think every one of these different varieties has their own characteristics. For example, plums, a part of the trick is all the pollinization that's involved. And because plums need to be pollinized by bees. Peaches and nectarines, for the most part, are self-pollinating. And I sort of gravitated toward that, maybe because I didn't get the life of bees early on. So I shifted over to this. And then I discovered that there are things about peaches, especially all of our peaches are yellow flesh with both high sugar and high acids.
Various varieties. Right?
Yeah, we have 12 different varieties, as I said, that ripen from the middle of May to the middle of August. And I love the fact of experimenting and pushing that nuances to affect both the sugar and the acids. To me, that was that complex nature pleasure of a fruit that I love. I guess winemakers love trying to balance all that together to create a flavor that has depth. I think that's what I'm trying to do with our fruit.
So it's not that you necessarily, that peaches are your favorite fruit to eat. It's because you have the most effect on them. You understand them so intimately that you can feel your impact on them as you grow them. Is that right?
Yeah, and maybe they like me, because at a certain point, we started developing an affinity with it where I understood and tried to capture, again, those stories behind the fruit, not only just my presence there, but looking at generations on the land, the history of the land, the social and political history that's part of who we are in this little farm south of Fresno.
Yeah, and plums can be a little rude, right, at times.
Yeah, plums didn't like me for some reason as much. I always thought, too, though, that there's this very rich history of peaches in Japanese culture and a very famous folk story called Momotaro, which it translates into the peach boy. In a nutshell, this young boy leaves. He's being raised. He was this childless couple found this giant peach floating in a stream. When they opened it up, this little boy jumped out, and he was raised by this very, very giving old couple. And he went off to find fortune. And along the way, he had to battle these orgs, and he combined his forces with a monkey, a dog, and a bird, and they defeated, sort of like Peter and the Wolf type thing, where they defeated the orgs, got fortune, and the main nature of the story is he brought fortune back to these parents because he felt out of their love for them.
That's very sweet.
So maybe I'm Momotaro in this century.
You certainly are. When did you find your passion for writing? And you have released 4 books.
Mm-hmm.
You have been published from the New York Times to pretty much every magazine and every newspaper. You're a columnist for the Fresno Bee.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When did you find that? Did you know always that you had a passion and a talent for writing? Your writing is exceptional. And as a farmer living close to the land and working with the land, you are the one telling the story through your markets and through... Actually, you were saying something interesting you said when we talked yesterday, that on this book tour that you're on right now, you're actually getting to interact with your product of writing, with your poetry, as much as you do with your produce when you sell it, with your peaches, even though some of your produce is sold through wholesale. But you love that interaction with the people who enjoy your art.
Clearly, a lot of farmers in this modern marketing system, we're distant from the people who are enjoying our fruits. Farmers markets, you have more of a connection. But that idea of bridging that, of not waving goodbye to a peach on a dock and hoping it arrives safely, it's like waving goodbye to a story and hoping that the readers someplace like it. And the danger in that, in both arenas, is that you end up with a very narrow definition of, quote, success. Usually with farm product, it's the price. If people pay more, they must like you. And if they pay less, they must hate you, which is not an indicator of your worth at all. And the same with writing. Does it mean that if I get a good review, people must like me? Or if books sell or don't sell, my stories are worthless. I wanted to go beyond that. And that's why I love interacting with audiences, either at readings or even over the radio and radio shows like this, because it allows you to bridge and make that connection more. And I think it helps complete the story. You asked, how did I begin to write? It was really that act of completing a story. It began within our little farm community. And I distinctly remember this. An old Japanese neighbor passed away. So we have fairly large funerals, and these are Buddhist funerals that go on for a long time. And I was often asked to give the eulogy. And a eulogy is really a collection of stories from someone's past. And I would begin to hear these marvelous stories of these old stoic neighbors that said 10 words to me in their entire life, and yet they always smiled. And I wanted to know what was the story behind them, and discovered that, you know, they were true pioneers. This one farmer, he was born in America, but his parents wanted to have him to have a Japanese education, so he went did live in Japan and educated in Japan, then came back. So in a way, he was without a country. He had no homeland in that sense, except his farm. So he would then begin to use his farm and massage it in a very unique way. And that generation was called Kibei. They were thought of as a very different type of Japanese American because they had these different characteristics. And their farms, by the way, you could almost see it as a Japanese garden because I think they had their training in Japan and brought back a different aesthetic of nature that they applied to their farm. And I loved the way they pruned their trees.
And the shomei, I mean, it's almost like a lineage, right? The shomei that don't disturb the soil at all.
Yeah.
They just like shovel away the leaves a little. And
wonderful cultural traditions that were brought. And that got woven into these stories that I started to tell, the stories I started to collect, and stories that I began to realize are integrated into the work that I do, into the farm that I have. So that when I started writing Wisdom of the Last Farmer, that story became so evident because Wisdom of the Last Farmer revolves around my father's stroke. And early in the book, I described discovering him behind a shed having a stroke. And the realization was...
When did he have a stroke?
Oh, in 1997. Mm-hmm. And there was this realization at that moment that the farm was going to change. And other types of understandings that... For my whole life, so long as you have your fathers with you, you're always the child and they're always the father. And in a lighter way, we had a wonderful relationship because I broke things and he fixed them. And it was this wonderful dynamic. And part of the discovery I had to make was that I was no longer the one that broke things. I also had to fix them too. And it changed our relationship. Part of the story in Wisdom of the Last Farmer was about in order for my dad to heal and recover, I had to teach him how to farm again to overcome the disabilities from the stroke.
Well, you are a father yourself, and in 1997, your daughter, which is the oldest, was already, 10 years old or mm-hmm. so, 11 years old. So you already went through that first phase of fatherhood, of becoming a father by being a father yourself. But there was still your father who you could depend on. And when that changes, it's almost like the last instant of stepping into that fatherhood, taking care of the people that birthed us.
One of the things that I learned and I write about in Wisdom was this knowledge my dad passed down. And it's a very simple idea that when you farm, your learning curves is counted in decades. Not in years, not in seasons, not in quarters. It's decades. And I was in my 40s when my father had the stroke. And I realized I was still a young farmer because I had only been on the land, even though I was raised there, I was only on the farming side by side with him for 15 years.
Were you ready? How does it feel? I mean, nobody asks you if you're ready. It happens when it happens. But what you were saying in a very polite way that you knew the farm would change. Well, your life changed that moment too.
Exactly. And that is part of that wonderful, wonderful learning with nature because life, death, changes, transitions, that's all part of nature at work. So farms should go through these ebbs and flows no differently than when you plant a crop or peach tree grows and sometimes survives for a long time. Other times you need to replant it. There's these rhythms of nature that we forget. So part of being a father and a son simultaneously was becoming a different type of teacher and student at the same time. So when my father had his stroke, I was going to have a role reversal with him because I would have to teach him. At the same time, my children growing up, what role would I start playing with them? Wonderfully, my daughter has expressed interest in taking over the farm. She's now 23. So we have a new relationship. And I like the lesson, the wisdom that my dad passed down, because instead of me worrying, I have to teach her everything I know in the next 2 to 3 years, I figure I have decades to teach her that. And it's the proper way to learn, because most of the lessons you learn on a farm is only through hard physical work and experience season
it's all
after
experiential,
season.
Of course.
Exactly.
Yes. Otherwise, you would just describe what you could do in, you know, instant.
Or it'd become a formula or a recipe.
Yeah,
and I think that's exactly the opposite of the way I want to farm. Organic, sustainable farming works is not by recipe. It's all through experience. I like to think of it, it's all through story.
So you were just coming back from Portland as part of your book tour a couple of days ago, and you have lots of events planned around Wisdom of the Last Farmer, which just came out, right? Beginning of
early August.
Yeah. Where can people see you? I know you have a couple of lectures or readings coming up this weekend even. And then next week you are at Toby's Feed Barn in West Marin and Point Reyes Station.
Yes.
Do you want to tell us where people can see you today?
Today I'll be at Book Passage at Ferry Plaza at 1 o'clock. Monday I'll be at Kepler's in Menlo Park at 7:30. Next Saturday we'll be at Toby's Feed Barn, and what a wonderful place to have a reading. And we plan to have some surprises and everything we want to try there too.
Like what?
I love the interact with the audience. And so it's not just a reading. It could get very interactive in many ways and very, how would you say, central. I won't want to give away other things we're trying to do there and stuff. And then everything, all my readings and appearances are posted on our webpage, which is www.masumoto.com. And it's this, I love meeting people and interacting with them. And the wonderful thing when I do these readings, I'll often meet people who said, yes, we've had your peaches. I go, well, tell me about them. Because it's an interaction that I often don't get. So.
And you have a very unique, we're almost out of time, but you have a very unique peach tree adoption program, where people can apply for adopting a tree, which brings in an enormous amount of fruit.
Yes.
I just learned, I talked to two people this week who have adopted one of your trees. And basically for 2-3 weeks, all you do is making jams. And
exactly. We have this wonderful old heirloom variety of Alberta. Which is a classic peach, and it's a peach that's wonderful for cooking with, baking with, canning, jamming. And we have this program where people fill out adoption papers, which they could get on our website, and then we select those that we want to match and pair with our peaches, because we take this very, very personal.
Don't say
and
pair.
And the key is that they have to come for harvest,
yes.
They come and they pick it, and each tree, usually it's groups that adopt it, will generate probably 500 pounds of peaches.
And coming to harvest is not a chore. It's actually, that's the idea, right? I mean, that's your
part
opportunity
of the,
to engage for them with their tree.
When they come to the farm, it's not we pick for them or a cute little you pick. It's how we pack our peaches, because
yes.
we wanted them to experience it. And when people come and see 500 pounds of peaches on a tree, at first their jaws drop
yes.
open.
You'll be sore after harvest. That's
which
for
is,
sure.
And I want them to sweat.
Yes.
Remember, it's hot
yes.
in Fresno.
Thank you so much, David Masumoto, farmer, activist, poet, father, husband, and author of Wisdom of the Last Farmer, this weekend here throughout the city, and next Saturday at Toby's Feed Barn in West Marin and Point Reyes Station. More information on Masumoto, MASUMOTO.com. Thank you, Mas, for coming. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
An Organic Conversation is produced by our wonderful Jen Lloyd. Production assistant is no longer Kristen O'Heary, but of course we miss her and wish her good luck in her new adventures. New production assistant is Justin Heary-Goyen. Underwriting production provided by The Ear, the one and only Mark Van Gelder. Thank you all, and also always thanks to the team here at Green 960, our very own Fab Five, Corey Calward, Mark McNone, Chris Gardinier, and of course John Scott and John Plessis. And also always thanks to our listeners for being part of this show and for actually listening. For blogs, podcasts, and more information on this show and previous shows, please visit our website at anorganicconversation.com. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can download An Organic Conversation to your iPhone or iPod and take us with you wherever you want to go, including to the Masumoto Family Farm in Fresno. We love to hear from you. Please send us your comments and questions to share at anorganicconversation.com. Coming up next is the Gavin Newsom Show, so please stay put. I'm your host, Helge Hellberg. Have a great weekend, and thanks again for listening to an organic conversation here on Green 960.